Good afternoon. First, I want to thank the previous two speakers for their insightful comments on a timely topic. We might even consider it a timeless topic, considering its unquestionable importance for the development and preservation of this broader concept of culture that is also our focus for this meeting. The title of my response is To Cultivate Our Poetic Soul, which is meant to shift the focus a little bit from those writers of verse to us readers of verse or artistic dilettantes, if we'd like to consider ourselves such. Dr. Maddox has already raised several important points, and I want to paraphrase one that grabbed my attention and on which I want to expand in this brief response. It is the following. Although poetry does seem to be having a bit of a renaissance in popular culture, that which it seeks to revitalize is merely the shell of poetry, not its essence. Likewise, even if the title of poet is gaining a new form of renown and use outside of the ivory tower, the label better describes the status of a person, not their soul. To put it another way, we do not realize the importance as a society in cultivating a poetic soul, which is now my task to define at least partially. The poetic soul is spiritual, by which I do not mean religious necessarily, rather inclined to have a reverent connection with the world by way of sensitivity and sensibility towards it. What makes the poetic soul spiritual, moreover, is that it entails a level of abstraction from the material world to fully develop our senses and attune them to experience life poetically. That is, through a connection and a combination of memory, which requires the general sense of time, lineage, and history in relation to ourselves, of wonder, wherein the mystery and complexity of the world compels the poet to be humble, patient, and observant, and finally of hope, which is not synonymous with optimism or happiness. Rather, it is a disposition that acknowledges the inherent insufficiency of our world on its own, without memory and without wonder, and that it also recognizes the fundamental beauty of the world that arises when we combine all of these things. I recognize that we are not all poets, but we all do possess poetic souls, albeit to different extents and in varied levels of development. Poetry speaks to us for this very reason. Poetry is necessary because it reminds us of this higher reality about ourselves in a world that is otherwise increasingly devoid of memory, wonder, and hope. The reality that we discover through poetry and art in general is that the combination of our spiritual faculties, again, hope, memory, and wonder, creates something that cultivates us and captures the human soul, unchanging and unwavering across the ages. To expand on these initial thoughts, allow me to also make use of two interlocutors, one Dr. Myers already mentioned, and the other I hope will be familiar to some members in the audience. Dr. Maddox aptly raised Oakeshott as one mentor who can help us understand the purpose of poetry better, and I want to introduce George Santayana, a philosopher, and T.S. Eliot, poet, as other worthy companions, each for a respective point that explain the poetic soul. The first, from Santayana, is about cultivating what he calls a sense of beauty, which Dr. Myers nicely touched on concluding his talk. The second, from Eliot, regards the role of the modern poet and the exigent element that is history and the past for his craft. I want to begin with Santayana. Poetry allows us to develop what he calls the ability to feel beauty, to have imagination and taste, to love the best, to be carried by the contemplation of nature to a vivid faith in the ideal. These are his words. For Santayana, poetry is not a source for knowledge, such as the type that rational discourse seeks, but it is a form of knowledge that cultivates our sensibility, he says, which allows us to approach the questions that most press upon us. He considers these to be, namely, how an ideal is formed in the mind, or what is the common element in all beautiful things, or, to get to the heart of the question, how is it that we come to be sensitive to beauty at all, or to value it? To read poetry, just as to compose it, then, is to partake in an aesthetic experience that explores these questions and serves as proof of their existing and everlasting validity. Yet the poet does not explain how to partake in aesthetic experience. He simply recreates the moment for the reader who is not there to experience it himself. The mark of the poet lies in his ability to convey, again, not to explain, the multiple contradictions that pervade our existence and still point towards the fact that beauty exists. Santayana describes it the following way, and I also want to excuse myself for a long quote, but some things are better said in the original voice of the authors. Santayana writes, and I quote, "The more blemishes the poet can see in man, the more excellence he sees in man. And the more bitterly he laments the fate of each particular soul, the more reverence and love he has for the soul in its ideal essence. The habit of looking for beauty in everything makes us notice the shortcomings of things. Our sense, hungry for complete satisfaction, misses the perfection it demands. But this demand for perfection becomes, at the same time, the nucleus of our observation. From every side, a quick affinity draws what is beautiful together and stores it in the mind, giving body there to the blind yearnings of our nature." End quote. I want you to notice the shift. The poet begins from a perception of imperfection that allows him to glimpse into things that he calls excellence and the soul, and to feel reverence and love for them. But then, the habit of seeking beauty is bound to lead us to disappointment, since it reveals to us life's inherent shortcomings. Yet, this very realization that life is incomplete is what causes us to idealize in our minds. In other words, to hope, to remember, and to wonder. The result is an appreciation for beauty, a sense for it, as he calls it. And I want to quote Santayana one final time again. He writes, "We develop a sense that the whole world is meant to be food for the soul, that beauty is not only its own, but all things' excuse for being. That universal aspiration towards perfection is the key and secret of the world. That sense is the poetical reverberation of a psychological fact, of the fact that our mind is an organism tending to unity." So these are just some of Santayana's musings about what he calls the poet in his work. But as I have already mentioned, Santayana is writing both for the literal poet who writes verse and for the reader of verse, whose poetic soul allows him to appreciate beauty. Both cultivate their sensibility through their engagement with the world. One expresses it in writing, and another engages with it through his reading of the other person's verses. The reason why this is important is because it demonstrates to us that poetry is inherently a social enterprise that demonstrates our connection with each other as humans in the past, present, and the future. Again, such is the purpose of art. It should go without saying that everything that Santayana identifies through his philosophy of aesthetics as part of the sense of beauty in artists is or ought to be universal. That said, in light of Dr. Maddox's conclusion for his talk, we are certainly led to wonder whether something is different about our modern world, in which, to borrow Dr. Maddox's terms, visibility seems to fare better than integrity in poetry. I do agree that valuing poetry for what it says rather than how it says it is to undermine its integrity, because it will eventually become subjugated to politics or theology, which makes it not art. This tendency seems to be indicative of a contemporary mode of thinking in which we think that we must be novel or new to be artists, which peculiarly translates into an implied or sometimes explicit rejection of everything that is from the past. This is a distinctly modern misconception about what constitutes art, and it serves as the moment to transition to Eliot's contribution to this conversation. Even a modernist poet like Eliot understood that modern literature was novel in form, not concept. The ideas that drive good poetry are the same everywhere, during any historical period, because art demonstrates the human experience is universal. Still, there was a philosophical disagreement between early modernist writers like Eliot and their successors, who also called themselves modernists, after what first began as an attempt to reimagine the form of writing turned into a self-conscious desire to break from the past completely and do something radically new. They forgot, in other words, the need for humility, reverence, and memory in art, and traded it for immediacy, for the here and now. Dr. Myers already alluded to this essay, but the 1917 essay, Reflections on Free Verse, is one in which Eliot wrote about how these theorists who hastily considered themselves modernists confused what he called the novelty of the form with the novelty of choice and the manipulation of material. The former was a mark of literary modernism that demanded artistic precision. The latter was only an illusion that contributed to a gradual simplification and obscurantism in art. Eliot's essay specifically targets free verse, which he considered a misnomer, since, as he writes, there is no freedom in art. These are rules that one must follow. These are things that one must consider before developing the ability to break from them. First, for example, the craft must be owned, the precision perfected, the discipline gained. Eliot criticized free verse for being made up by a group of theorists who would either revolutionize or demoralize art. His emphasis on the word theory reveals his concern for the future of poetry, years before Dana Gioia would write his essay on the question of can poetry matter. Eliot argued that the obsession with novelty of choice provokes the artist to radically break from his own past, rather than to use it as a tool for his own inspiration to create a novel form. Modernist artists then had to choose between being modern in a manner of expression or being modern in their place and time, therefore always disassociating themselves from the past. One is formed, the other is fleeting. And as Eliot lamented, most of the later modernists chose the second option. And I do believe that this choice has contributed to the current state of affairs with poetry and art more broadly. So I too am in agreement with Dr. Myers's view that modernism carries most of the blame, but specifically the type of modernism that Eliot described in his essay. After all, the word modern has been part of the English vernacular since at least the 16th century, and its Latin version, modernus, has been with us since the 6th. The Latin root modo has two meanings. Furthermore, it can mean just now, or it can also mean in a certain manner. A shift towards the second understanding of what it means to be modern would certainly correct several of these problems with contemporary poetry and art more generally. So as I have hinted, an indispensable solution lies in cultivating our poetic souls once more and understanding why this was something that was so integral to earlier artists that we tend to revere or read or enjoy reading. In ourselves, especially than our artists, the people who are dilettantes, as I said earlier, because it teaches us to develop our taste. Aesthetic judgments, Santayana affirmed, are just like moral judgments. They are undeniably judgments of value. Just as we have a code by which we inculcate a particular moral system to our children, so too is a particular type of aesthetic appreciation inculcated by what we read, what we hear, and what we see. It is a type of aesthetic education that takes the past into account seriously, and even grants it a bit of primacy. In terms of the art itself, we should engage with art that prioritizes the result of the work over the intention, that values complexity over simplicity, thought and emotion over commercial catchphrases, doubt over uncertainty, humility over confidence. I am not too worried about finding artists and poets who meet these criteria. I do believe that they are out there, as they have always been. We just don't know them yet because there is so much more fluff going around. The danger lies in our inability to identify them. Making ourselves more open to aesthetic experience is something of which everyone is capable, however, and we must do it. The task for us is simply to recognize that poetry matters, that beauty matters, and force ourselves out of the rhythm to which we have become accustomed that distances us from beauty, of work, of production, efficiency, rationalism, prestige, knowledge, etc., which are not bad in themselves, but certainly in excess, detach us from our ability to connect to the world and to see it through this kind of aesthetic dimension that Santayana advocates. And to slow down instead, to take time to make room for beauty in an effort to cultivate our poetic souls so that we might inspire others to do the same. Thank you.